This is an ABC podcast.
Live across Victoria.
On the ABC Listen app.
Your smart speaker.
And on your radio.
This is ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
The conversations that are important to you. In your town. Your suburb.
This is The Conversation Hour.
You're with Georgie Coghlan.
Someday you will find. In a champagne supernova in the sky, someday you will find me.
It's been 30 years since that song was released. Can you believe it? But here's a question for you. Are you hearing it being blasted from your teenager's bedroom? And have you noticed your 15-year-old is binge-watching Friends and Seinfeld? And maybe they're also listening to Radiohead, learning the lyrics of Creep and asking, Mum, have you ever used a Walkman before? Why are Gen Z chasing that old 90s feeling despite never being alive in the 90s? Well, this morning we're celebrating the 90s, the music, the TV shows, the vibe, and we'll find out why Gen Z love this era. Happy Friday. I'm Georgie Coghlan, filling in for Mary Guerin. And before we go back to the 90s, a new study released today reveals that there is a huge gap in our understanding of the risks and the prevention of dementia. So we'll talk about what you can do to help prevent dementia and understand the signs that you should look out for. This is The Conversation Hour. So if you were to guess what was the leading cause of death among Australian women, what would you say? Would you say cancer? Would you say heart disease? Well, it is dementia, and more than 60% of all people who die from dementia in Australia are women. A study released today reveals only one in six women know that dementia is the leading cause of death. And most are unaware that factors such as blood pressure and hearing problems can influence dementia risk. So joining us this morning is Dr. Sarah White. She's the CEO of the Jean Hales Foundation. She's back by popular demand because she was talking to Mary yesterday. Good morning again, Sarah.
Oh, that's very kind of you, Georgie. I'm not sure about popular demand.
Well, it's wonderful to have you back. Thank you so much for joining us. This is a fascinating study, a really important study. Sarah, what did the study find?
Well, the study really showed us that very few women know that dementia is the leading cause of death for Australian women. And the reason that's important is because what underpins that is a lack of knowledge about some of the factors we can do that reduce our risk of actually developing dementia or potentially delaying the onset progression of dementia.
So, Sarah, it sounds like an obvious question, but why is dementia affecting more women than men? Is it simply because women live longer?
That used to be the prevailing view, and certainly that contributes an enormous amount. So the single biggest risk factor is age. But this longevity doesn't entirely explain the differences. So the picture that's emerging is really we've got a combination of biological factors, social and lifestyle factors that are making that risk slightly high, or that progression slightly higher for women.
Sarah, I'm not sure how much study's been done on this, but what role do diminishing hormones and menopause play in dementia?
We don't really know yet is the honest and simple answer. There's certainly a really strong theory around the effects of estrogen protecting the brain, but that in itself and alone is not sufficient. So there are 14 modifiable risk factors and hormones don't yet appear in that list.
Okay, so before we go into those 14 risk factors or the way that we can try and prevent dementia, the study reveals, which was fascinating to me, Sarah, that 45% of cases may be preventable. That is a significant number. So how do we get women to live longer and, of course, in better health?
So these 14 risk factors actually apply both to women and men. So I want all of the listeners out there to grab hold of these ideas for everybody. Mm-hmm. But they're slightly different for women, but it will help everybody. So the 14 factors, we've got things like limited education. It does come down to use it or lose it. High blood pressure, that's something that we should all be looking to control. Hearing loss, something else that we can address as we get older. Smoking, still in there as a problem. Obesity and overweight, sometimes very hard to manage, but certainly another impetus to do so. Mm-hmm. Depression, definitely something that we think is sitting behind why more women might develop dementia.
Okay.
Physical and activity. Look, some of these things are very protective for the heart as well as the brain. Uncontrolled diabetes, traumatic brain injury, alcohol consumption, so excessive alcohol consumption, again, something that underpins so much of our health. An interesting one might be social isolation. So as we get older, we lose some of those social connections. Mm. Maintaining those is really important. Air pollution, some things, of course, we can't change too much, or we take a long time to change. But the final two are treatable and very able to be addressed. So it's untreated vision loss and it's high LDL cholesterol. Some of these things are easily managed, going to see your GP and getting on a plan to help with those things.
You're listening to The Conversation Hour with Georgie Coghlan. I'm talking to Dr. Sarah White, the CEO of Jean Hales, and we're talking about the fact that more than 60% of all people who die from dementia in Australia are women. What I'm fascinated about that list, Sarah, what sticks out to me, the hearing loss and the vision loss.
Mm.
So let's unpack that a little bit, because I know with my parents initially, they were quite hesitant to have hearing aids because they can be quite self-conscious about that. And then what happened, particularly with my father, he didn't feel comfortable with a hearing aid, so therefore he tended to withdraw from conversation, and I could see him sort of withdrawing socially because he couldn't hear in a room. Why is that so important for the brain, for the hearing loss and the vision loss in the link to dementia?
Probably a better question for Dementia Australia, but my understanding is that this is still really activating parts of the brain, and it's also, exactly to your point, it is increasing that social isolation. We want the brain to be working, and if you're closing down parts of it, withdrawing because you're having trouble hearing, then you're really not using all of it and you are socially withdrawing, which is a whole separate modifiable risk factor. But I think what these modifiable risk factors can do is help us reframe that conversation. So let's not be self-conscious about wearing those hearing aids. Let's think of it as a very proactive piece about keeping our health. And maybe we can have conversations with the loved ones in our lives. And I'm certainly thinking of my own father, who doesn't want to wear his hearing aids either. Mm. We can talk to them about, well, it's not just about they don't look great. This is actually about protecting your brain.
That's right. And I used to have jokes about Dad that, you know, you still need to be able to hear my jokes. You still need to hear about me being cheeky. Dad, you can't get away with that. And it was a process, because for him it was about losing his autonomy, which was quite confronting for him. We'd love to hear from you, 1300 222 774, particularly if you have a loved one who has dementia, if you are a carer or if you live with dementia, or give me a text, 0437 774 774. Sarah, I've got a really interesting text that's come through. Georgie, can you please get your guest, Dr. Sarah White, to clarify, do you die from dementia or die with dementia?
You do die from dementia.
Interesting.
Yeah. Mm,
okay. Well, what about sleep, Sarah? I know that we are getting more and more research and awareness about the importance of sleep. Is sleep linked to dementia?
Sleep doesn't appear in these 14 modifiable risk factors. These risk factors came from what's called a Lancet Commission piece. So it's one of the top medical journals in the world, and they gathered these experts together to say these are the risk factors. But sleep is so important it's not in the list, sure, but sleep is so important, for example, for depression, which is one of those modified risk factors. And it's important, I think, to note these are risk factors, they're not proven causes. So if you have hearing loss, that does not mean you are going to get dementia. Mm-hmm. There's a combination of these things together that are increasing the risk. So I don't want anyone out there to think, oh, I have dementia or my mum has dementia, we did something wrong. That's not the case.
Yes.
What we're saying is there are some things that we can do to lower your risk of developing dementia.
Sarah, what about encouraging people to do the Wordle every day or do a crossword? Or I used to encourage my dad to read the papers every day just so his brain was processing information.
We have a GP here who runs our brain care clinic who says if you do Sudoku, you'll get very good at Sudoku, but you might not actually do much around dementia. we really need to challenge our brain. So it's probably less about doing the crossword every day and more about doing something like, let's learn a new language, let's learn an instrument, let's learn a new
task. That's tough, Sarah, learning a new language, but I'm the pointy end of life.
It could be a language, Georgie. It could be, I don't know, tell your dad he can learn to knit, something
okay.
like that.
That sounds great. We're talking about boot scooting later in the program, so maybe they could learn how to do a little
boot
cheeky
scooting
boot scooting.
Great.
I love
Absolutely.
It. Okay, Sarah White, CEO of Jean Hales, great to talk to you again. Thank you so much for joining us and increasing our awareness of this really important issue.
Thanks, Georgie.
We're going to jump now to Rebecca Schooler, and she's a carer. Her mother recently passed away from dementia, and she very kindly joins us now. Good morning, Rebecca. Thanks so much for speaking to us on the Conversation Hour.
Good morning.
I'm really sorry, Rebecca, to hear about your mum's passing. I understand you were her carer, and can you sort of take us back to her journey and the first moment that you realised something might not be quite right with your mum?
Sure. Mum was diagnosed in 2017, and there's always a few signs, I think, leading up to having the very difficult conversation about perhaps going to get tested for dementia, and that in itself is a challenge. But there's always some obvious ones that stand out. So for mum, joking about putting the vegetables in the freezer or accidentally using the salt instead of the sugar in her very famous cupcakes. They were obvious ones, but some more subtle ones that people may not notice, which is my mum and I always shared crime fiction novels, would pass them to each other when we visited, and then she seemed to lose interest in reading, which I thought was odd.
Right.
But in hindsight, makes lots of sense.
So what was the next step after that, Rebecca? What did you do once you sort of noticed those little changes? What did you do next in terms of getting some sort of intervention?
Partly because my mum was ageing and lived down the south coast where there's not a, of New South Wales, where there's not necessarily a lot of medical facilities and support. Mum and I had a discussion and she relocated to Canberra, which was a big decision in her late 70s. Mm. Then I won't deny there were a few robust conversations about whether you needed to be tested, and that's understandable. It's such a hard thing to face.
How did that go, Rebecca? Can I just unpack that a little bit for people listening? What did you initiate that, and what did you say?
I did initiate some of these conversations, suggesting that perhaps mum might want to speak with her GP, and presented some examples of some things that made me think that it might be dementia and not ageing. My mum, a beautiful, beautiful woman, but could get quite fiery. And so some of those discussions could be challenging. And look, they're not easy to have. And I think, like you were saying about hearing loss with your dad, the more that you can have other people bring someone along on that journey, it's a bit easier. But for me, it was primarily my mum and me. And then I brought our GP into that conversation.
I'm speaking with Rebecca Schooler, and Rebecca's mum recently passed away from dementia. She's very kindly talking about her story to help others and awareness of others. As we hear today, a new study revealing that Australian women, it is the leading cause of death, dementia in Australian women, and trying to sort of get more awareness about what we can do to try and prevent dementia. So, Rebecca, what helped your mum most once there was the diagnosis that she had dementia? What helped her most day to day?
To be fair, you get very little information, and I hope that is changing with time. You get this, you've got dementia, and off you go into right. this world of trying to navigate that yourself. We learnt a lot doing a course with Dementia Australia called Living with Dementia, mm-hmm. and that gave us some advice. But mostly I learnt things from other carers, which is great, but there should be a better system, I think, with the health system providing that information up front.
Yes.
So that was, I think, is a bit of a challenge in that journey. So I think if you have more information up front, so you can start setting up processes, especially noting how long it takes now to get a home care package, you need to be on these things sooner rather than later. And if you don't have the information, that makes it very difficult.
Well, I mean, even Rebecca, something that you could watch with your mum or your dad, your loved one online, like a video that sort of goes through what to expect, what helps, if so that you can do that straight away and together. Would that have been helpful as a starting point?
I think it would have been. And I did use resources that were on the Dementia Australia website and did a bit of research. But also you're just confronted with a whole lot of things. So it's very hard to take it all on board. Mm. So something that would make it easier, I think someone counselling, I think, is very important and not something that many people undertake.
Yes. Rebecca, were there any moments of humour, connection or some unexpected positives along the way that happened between you and your mum?
Look, I was a carer for 10 years and mum passed away in March, but always some really special moments, and it's a bit of a privilege to have had those. Mum was a part of the Alchemy Chorus, which is a dementia choir here in Canberra. And to watch Mum's face completely light up when she sang with the choir and sing every single word, might not have remembered afterwards that she'd been to choir, was always amazing to watch and always brought a tear to my eye. Mm. Even late last year, Mum came out with childhood nicknames that I had forgotten. So she walked in and looked at me and said, "Oh, Tootsie Wootsie." And I was like, "Oh, that's right." And Becky Wecky. And so it was so nice to hear those and have that memory of that comeback.
Yes, get those beautiful moments. Of you know, and the beautiful moments of you as mother and daughter and what you'd shared throughout your life. Oh, that's a beautiful story to finish, Rebecca. I just love that you have that memory of your mum beaming. And as you say, despite having dementia, knowing every single lyric with that musical memory in her brain.
Music and dementia is incredible. And the choir, because they're not being judged, they're up there singing, they feel confident because they can sing, is really a moment of respite.
Yes. Yes.
For people living with dementia and their carers to be in that moment.
Rebecca, we're so grateful for you sharing your story today of your beautiful mum, and particularly when it must be still really raw for you given that she's only passed away in March. What would you, just to leave us today, what would you most want listeners to understand about the person behind the diagnosis, the dementia?
Treat them with respect and treat them as a whole person, because often people ignore them. So whether they don't look at them at medical appointments, or they just make these assumptions about this person who is still an incredible person. Mm-hmm. They just can't always articulate what they want or what they're trying to express. But if you're patient, that will shine through.
Beautiful message. Rebecca Schooler, thank you so much for joining us this morning on The Conversation Hour.
Thank you.
This is The Conversation Hour. You're listening to Georgie Coghlan. We are talking about a study that's been released today revealing that only 1 in 6 women know that dementia is the leading cause of death for women, and most of us are unaware that factors such as blood pressure, hearing problems, sight problems can influence our dementia risk. We're now going to speak to Kimberly Roberts, Executive Director of Dementia Australia. Kimberly, thank you so much for joining us this morning on The Conversation Hour.
Hi, Georgie. Thank you for having us.
I'm sure you've been inundated with requests like us, because it's a big day. This is a fantastic study. First of all, a lot of people would be surprised, Kimberly, to hear that dementia is actually the leading cause of death among Australian women. Why do you think awareness is still so low?
Look, 62% of people who do pass away from dementia are women. And dementia is now the leading cause of death of all Australians as well. And I think one of the biggest challenges we're facing is the stigma that sits around dementia. And Rebecca mentioned that in her conversation, people are scared to talk about it. And as a result, we're missing out on the opportunity of doing something about it.
Mm. So what are some of the earliest warning signs, Kimberly, that families should be looking out for?
There's many things that people should be looking out for. And dementia comes in so many different forms and impacts people so many different ways. So if you've got any concerns about changes, you should contact your GP. But the study spoke to the fact that there's so many lifestyle choices people can be making now to reduce their chance of risk of getting dementia. And we should be talking about that so we can impact the outcomes.
We're getting a couple of texts coming through. We're loving this. Keep the texts coming. A text here: my mum and dad didn't ever drink. They ate healthy food. They were never overweight. They walked daily, were both very intelligent, and they both died of Alzheimer's. My mum was 74. Is that still a common story, Kimberly, where you've got families that are doing all the right things, so to speak, but dementia is still affecting people?
Absolutely. You can't change aging, you can't change genetics, and you can't change family history. Mm-hmm. And they do impact dementia and your chance of getting dementia. And the fact that in Australians, women live longer, and we know dementia is linked to age as well, but that doesn't mean that there isn't things you can still do to reduce that risk.
What are some of the misconceptions about dementia, Kimberly, that you'd like people to stop believing?
Dementia Oh, this is a really hard one because people are all impacted differently and feel quite different about it. And I think Rebecca made a great comment about respect and the fact that people are, a significant number of people with dementia are still living in the community. And what people should know is that them and the carers are trying to do their best to live a normal life, and we should help them and show them respect while they're in the community.
I mean, we're at an interesting point, Kimberly. I mean, this is a question without notice, but you look at, in terms of the federal government, they are encouraging more and more elderly people through their aged care program to stay at home. Do you think we're heading in the wrong direction, given that social connection community is so important for our brain health and is linked to dementia? Do you think we should be encouraging more of our aged care to participants to be in community rather than getting care at home?
I think a lot of people love staying at home because they're surrounded by their loved ones, and I think that's an individual choice for everyone. The government has recently announced some additional funding for research, but we already know that there's things that we can be doing today to reduce our risk, and we should be talking about how we can get brain health as part of a national conversation.
Kimberly Roberts, Executive Director of Dementia Australia, thank you so much for speaking with us today. A really important study, and thank you for sharing your thoughts and increasing our awareness of dementia.
Thanks, Georgie. Appreciate it.
This is The Conversation Hour. You're listening to Georgie Coghlan.
This is The Conversation Hour with Georgie Coghlan.
Today is gonna be the day that they're gonna throw it back to you. By now you should have somehow realized what you gotta do. I don't believe that anybody feels the way I do about you now.
Oh yes, where were you when Oasis released this song? Can you believe it was 1995? How old were you? Can you remember what you were doing? Would you love to return to that time and place? Are you nostalgic about the 1990s? Well, right now in a world that feels constantly switched on, fast, overwhelming and just a bit too much, people are craving nostalgia more than ever. And not just those of us who actually lived through the 90s, but Gen Z as well, which when you think about it is fascinating because many of them, of course, were born long after the decade ended. They've never experienced and been alive in the 90s. So, like me, why is your 15-year-old suddenly obsessed with Friends reruns? Why are teenagers discovering through TikTok all of the 1990s bands, learning every word to Radiohead's Creep? I do love it. And what's one song, TV show, band or moment from the 90s that transports you back there? Why do you think we're all craving that feeling again right now? Well, Professor Dan Woodman is a sociologist from the University of Melbourne. He's a lover of all things 90s and nostalgia, and he joins me this morning to unpack it. Good morning, Dan.
Morning, Georgie. I am feeling nostalgic after opening with that Oasis song.
Do you love this topic? I get a feeling that you're just living and breathing this.
Well, this is my life. You know, there's a kind of truism that people think that the music from their teens and early adulthood is the best music ever.
Well, it is, isn't it?
Yeah, well, that's it. We can see that there's a kind of generational pattern to that. But it just happens to be objectively true in my case that the 1990s was actually the best.
So let's get it clear. So you and I, Dan, are Gen X.
Yeah, I'm just sneak into Gen X. But yeah,
I'm a bit cheeky calling you Gen X. I'm full on Gen X.
I want to be. I really do. And I was in my mid-teens when that Oasis song came out. And it was... You know, the memories are bittersweet, let's say that. You know, there were some wonderful things about being 15, 16 years old, but also a few things from that era that I'm probably glad we've left behind.
Yeah, right. Like you sort of look back, because I was looking at the whole concept of this historical nostalgia, which is when we long for a time, this is for Gen Z, that we never lived in. And I suppose I feel a little bit lucky because I don't long for a time because I feel like I was in the best time. I got the 80s and the 90s, so I'm like, I was there. So your research tracks Gen Z. Tell us a bit about Gen Z, Dan.
So with colleagues at the University of Melbourne, we've been tracking young people through their late teens and 20s for a few generations now.
Right.
So the study actually started with Gen X by some colleagues. I'm far too young to have started the study.
But, for sure.
So we're able to see how being a young person has changed across Gen X, the millennials or Gen Y, and now Gen Z. And in some ways, it's important to recognise that nostalgia is not new, and almost every 5 years something will come out saying everyone's nostalgic now.
Of course,
yes. And they did it used to be. But you know, I was listening to the greatest hits of the 60s and 70s in the 90s. But the young people today are living in a time of uncertainty where the future feels a bit shaky. And again, that's something that every generation faces in one way, but it is sharp now.
100%. I think that's the difference. And when I went down a bit of a rabbit hole with this story, because I love it, Dan, and I've got a daughter who is Gen Z, let's talk about what they're worried about, why they're feeling like this, because they have huge insecurities. They're worried about the environment. They're worried about getting a job. They're worried about never having a house. They're worried about study. Do you think that Gen Z wants stability and meaning and want to sort of belong somewhere because the present doesn't really make sense to them at the moment?
Yes, I think if you go back to the 1990s, the young people we were following then also were kind of disappointed with the world they found, because this was a generation that was told to finish high school, do more study, and you'll get these rewards for it. The job market will provide for you. And then it didn't. But for a little while they were in their teens and 20s, they still hope that it did. And, you know, eventually things did turn around for that cohort. But I think the generation now sees the world changing quickly, AI emerging, and other things where it's not that they're giving up on their future at all, but there's a hint of pessimism right there through their teens and young adulthood that maybe the future isn't going to look better than the past.
And we're also talking about a cohort, Dan, that helped create this social media machine. And now it feels like that is very much consuming them.
Yeah, and it's not like everyone's throwing their phones in the Yarra River and moving back to writing long pen letters to friends. But yeah, there is a kind of deep ambivalence about technology and what it means for the quality of relationships. And also, as we were saying, what it might mean for the quality of our work lives, our intimate relationships, and even our democracy and society into the future.
You're listening to The Conversation Hour. This is Georgie Coghlan. I'm talking with Professor Dan Woodman. He's a sociologist from the University of Melbourne. And we're talking about the fact that Gen Z are obsessed with the 90s, despite never living there. Love it. Historical nostalgia. Want to hear from you. What's your song, TV show, band or moment from the 90s that transports you back? And does it make you feel safe? Or what does it make you feel? Why do you love it? 1-300-222-774-0437-774-774. I've got a text here. I love the 90s. I'm celebrating my 50th next weekend with a 90s-themed party. Everyone is super stoked to be dressing up in this era, including the teenagers. That's from Suze in Barwon Heads. I love it, Suze. What a great theme. So is there a simplicity to the 90s that Gen Z are longing for, Dan?
Yeah, well, I'm just thinking there are these kind of fashion trends of 20 or 30 years or so. And one great thing about having a 1990s party now is you can go to the shops and see 90s style stuff all over the place. I think there is this sense that it was a simpler time, although, you know, it was a time of other challenges, like it had its genocides and wars and pandemics, the 1990s too. And in some ways the technology was simpler, but it was still frustrating. We'd moved from this great leap forward, which was the portable tape player, Sony Walkman, to the great leap backwards, which was the CD Walkman or Discman.
Oh, remember the Walkman? Well, I was lucky I had a Walkman and then I had a Discman. But my favourite memory, Dan, is when Barry Bissell would come on for the top 40 and I'd have my little cassette player and I had to push three buttons and I had to time it so when Barry stopped talking for the intro of the song and pressing it. And sometimes Barry would talk over the intro and I'd be like, Barry, stop it, and trying to get my little tape, and then I would pause it to get my mixtape.
Oh, yes. My attitude towards the broadcasters was very mixed because they just would not stop talking when the song would start.
What?
That's how we did our version of Spotify in that day. We made our own mixtapes taping off the radio. We also, like, it was a simpler time, but we had, my family, well through to my end of my teenage years, we only have one phone, and it was on a cord, but it was stuck to the wall.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, I could stretch it just far enough to close the laundry door.
To get some privacy.
Yeah, but I had to have my head, like, next to the door. And if I did that, I come out and my brothers and even my mum will be like, "Oh, who are you talking to?" And, you know, I've heard stories from others about that, you know, the really fancy tech advanced people had two phones in their house, and your little sibling could pick up the other one and hear you chatting
or
on
your
the
mum.
Other end.
And you'd be talking to your boyfriend
yeah.
and your mum's quietly pulled it up the receiver and you didn't know, and then you'd hear this little cheeky click at the end and
yeah,
realise that they'd
right.
been listening to everything.
Yeah, and obviously social media bullying is terrible, but come on, you know, imagine living with that.
Yes. I'm talking to Dan Woodman. He's a professor of sociology at the University of Melbourne. We're talking about why Gen Z love the 90s. They are a bit worried about the world, understandably, in the 90s. Gives them, I suppose, some sort of anchor, Dan. How does marketing play into this with Gen Z? Because we're seeing everything on TikTok, Instagram, reeling them in.
Yeah, and I guess that is like putting a bit of a grain of salt around the idea that the 90s was the best time and the new generation's just discovered it. These trends do come around quickly, and we seem to have a youth culture now, but general culture that does have bits and pieces from all different eras getting picked up and packaged in global trends for a little while. But, you know, the 80s, 2000s, maybe even 70s are going to have their time again. But the other thing is that it's not only marketers, but also politicians or anyone who's trying to persuade us have known for quite a while that nostalgia does work.
It does.
It's a really powerful way
yes.
to get our emotions up and make us think about how things could be better, whether it's through voting for this person who will make whatever it is great again, or through, you know, buying their product or getting the pair of jeans from the jean shop that look just like the ones your mum had 30 years ago.
Well, that's right, because I'm Gen X, you just sneak in, but we're so reflective and nostalgic about the 90s, but we had, of course, the Port Arthur massacre, we had the HIV pandemic, we had the 90s recession. It wasn't without its challenges.
We also had Right Said Fred. You know, like, not all the youth culture was great at that time. You know, there's some songs that are getting replayed like Oasis and they're still on tour, but I'm glad we've left I'm Too Sexy to the bin of history, I guess.
So does what we listen to as kids through our parents play a huge role in the bands and our influence on nostalgia? I mean, our daughter has been exposed to everything from REM, Midnight Oil, INXS. Have your team and you looked at anything in terms of the influence in terms of nostalgia, Dan?
Well, I'll just say what an excellent education in culture that is. But, yeah, I guess, like, it's again something about the social science of generations is often we start to build our own culture as young adults and be part of a youth culture through making fresh contact with the culture that we inherit and from our parents. And for a lot of people, the first music they started listening to, like I remember my mum and dad having the Elvis and Beatles records that I put on when I was around 10 or 12. And, you know, I still like that music to this day. And that is often the way we first start to get a contact with pop culture. And it's also a good thing to remind us that nostalgia isn't all backwards looking and it can be creative. That a lot of musicians and movie makers and people who shape the culture do draw and repurpose and make new and for new times some ideas or sounds or trends or ways of doing culture that they've picked up from previous generations.
I'm talking to Dan Woodman, Professor of Sociology at the University of Melbourne. We're talking about nostalgia. I've got a text here. Nostalgia isn't what it used to be.
Our nostalgia back in the day was the best nostalgia.
Another text. Love the 90s, but not Oasis. Awful band. Okay. Okay, we welcome all points of view here on the Conversation Hour. We'd love to hear from you, 1300 222 774, or send us a text, 0437 774 774. Do you have a favourite 90s memory? Or you can give me anything that you're nostalgic about if you like. It's Friday. It's been a big week for lots of us. Love to hear from you. Let's talk about, Dan, in terms of Gen X, there's a lot of anniversary tours happening now. What are the economics behind this? I mean, Gen X can potentially now, not everyone, but some can afford to go. How is that sort of playing out?
Yeah. So the boomers probably started it to some extent, but the Gen Xers have maybe really mainstreamed the idea that your youth culture isn't just for when you're young. Mm. It's we kind of age along with our youth culture, and that's it, you know. I'm kind of glad that the 90s are back because it means the same fashion I've been wearing for the last 30 years suddenly is back in a little bit.
Dust it off. Yeah.
And that's it. It's like... The idea that you have kids and then you put on a cardigan and watch the 6 PM news and that's what adults do has kind of shifted. And now we think that, you know, you should still be going out with your friends, going to concerts. Life sometimes, not for everyone, but for a lot of people, life gets in the way in the 30s and maybe even early 40s. But when you get to around the age of Gen Xers, at least some have a little bit of time again if they have been parents. And sometimes the bank balance is looking a little bit healthier. So bands have realized that, you know, that I could still be selling out a reasonable sized venue with expensive tickets, doing the album that, you know, the middling second album that I released in 1996. It's time for the 30 year tour.
Example, Oasis. Let's go to Kira. Hi, Kira. Are you reminiscent or nostalgic about the 90s?
Well, I'm just reflecting on what you guys have been saying. I grew up listening to Creedence and Simon and Garfunkel because that was what my dad was listening to. And then not long ago, I've got a 21-year-old and a 19-year-old, and the music that was coming out of the bathroom was Rasputin.
Oh, I love that, Kira.
I feel like I've trained them well in Star Wars and their education is complete.
Kira, I do love your musical exposure that you were given to with Simon and Garfunkel too. What a great way in terms of a young person being exposed to top-notch music. What was your favourite Simon and Garfunkel?
Cecilia.
Oh, yes.
You're breaking my heart.
And I, the muscle memory, as soon as those songs come on, I word for word.
Oh, absolutely love it. Kira, well done, and well done exposing your kids to fantastic music culture. Thank you for calling us. Have a great day.
Thank you.
If you just joined us, it's The Conversation Hour. This is Georgie Coghlan. I'm talking to Dan Wilburn, Professor of Sociology at the University of Melbourne, and we're unpacking why Gen Z always love to go back to the 90s despite not living there. Dan, fantastic and fascinating talk here. What are your personal reflections on growing up in the 90s? I heard a cheeky rumour that you're a bit of an Ethan Hawke fan.
I was just thinking about the last caller and how I wish I could remember the material I have to deliver in my lecture this week as well as I could remember.
What's your lecture this week?
We're wrapping up the semester, so it's covering all about sociology and the way it might prepare you for the jobs of the future, actually. Uh-huh. But I can't remember the details of that, but I can tell you the lyrics to an Everclear song from 1994, word for word. So it's funny how that pop culture can really embed itself so deeply in our brains. And that's it. Like, some of those movies I will still go back and watch now. And it's interesting, my children are kind of into my music, but I've struggled a little bit with the movies.
Right.
I think it's the TV shows are okay, but the movies, just the pacing and the length of them and other things, don't maybe fit with the way people consume culture now. And honestly, some of the movies I did like in the 1990s.
I was a Pretty Woman fan.
Yeah.
Indecent Proposal. Do you remember that one?
Yes, I do. And I like this movie called Ace Ventura. And then I was looking back at it to maybe watch with my children. And I'm like, oh, no, we can't watch this again. But at least some Ethan Hawke things, I think, hopefully still stand up. And I've been told by some serious authorities, including my wife, that Reality Bites is definitely watch that is a rewatch.
Winona Ryder, yeah?
Yeah. Any year, any time.
Let's go to Lou. Good morning, Lou. How are you this morning? Hello, Lou. Sorry, we came in too late there. Good morning. What would you like to share about nostalgia, Lou?
Hello. I'm ringing to defend Right Said Fred because that song is genius.
Oh, I agree. I agree.
And Dan, if you had a few drinks and it got put on late at a party, I swear I think you'd have a boogie. my 21-year-old is obsessed with watching Fried Green Tomatoes at the Whistle Stop Cafe.
Oh, I love that, Lou.
And I sort of remembered back and I said to her, oh, look, there weren't many female-driven, female-led films back then. They were such blokey stories.
Yes.
And she loves that movie. She watches it daily.
Is that Kathy Baker?
Kathy Bates.
Yeah, Kathy Bates, yes.
Sarah Jessica Parker. And it's a really great movie. I watched it again with my daughter and I just was like, oh. So I got really nostalgic about that movie.
Love it, Lou. I love it when you stumble back, yes, on an absolute golden movie like that and you can share it with the next generation. Love it, Lou. Thank you so much for defending I'm Too Sexy. I'm with you. Have a great day, Lou.
You too. Bye.
I have added Fried Green Tomatoes onto my watch list, but I don't think Right Said Fred's back on the listen list.
Let's go to Chris. Good morning, Chris. Do you have a particular band that you were fond of from the 90s?
Well, as I was saying, there was four bands that came out with albums all within a few months of each other. Soundgarden, Smashing Pumpkins, Pearl Jam, and Nirvana.
Yes, how good was Pearl Jam? Well, they still are, of course.
10 is a seminal album. They've got a lot of hits on it, and it really launched that kind of music, that grunge, I hate the word grunge, but hard rock music into back in, because Michael Jackson was teeing up for a big album with History, and these guys come along and said, well, we just want to rock. So,
Chris, I love that. You've taken me back because Pearl Jam was massive when I was sort of 17 or 18 and when I went to uni and we would drink lots of drinks to Pearl Jam.
What a few months. And I guess the challenge was a CD cost you almost $30 back then. So it would be a few months worth of your salary to buy those four CDs as well back in the early 1990s.
Chris, thank you so much for sharing that. Do you have a favourite song from Pearl Jam?
Either Even Flow or Jeremy. But I really like the collaboration between Eddie Vedder and Chris Cornell from Soundgarden. Temple of the Dog has a song called Hunger Strike.
Oh, how good is Eddie Vedder? Massive fan.
Yeah, and it's Chris Cornell, one of the heaviest singers ever. I just love it. And he wrote a lot of really good, great music as well, not all rock. Heavy stuff. He's got a few acoustic kind of sounding. He's on the soundtrack to Superman when he's early on in the movie. Chris Cornell was just a hero of mine. And
thank you, Chris. Loved hearing your thoughts, and thank you for taking us down memory lane. Appreciate your call.
Pearl Jam was the second concert I ever went to, so it's really down memory lane for me. And it was a lot cooler than the first concert, so I tend to pretend it was actually the first one I went to.
We'll quickly go to Tim before we wrap. Good morning, Tim. What would you like to share? Hello, Tim.
Yeah. You only liked the 90s because you weren't there in the 60s.
Oh, I love it, Tim. What was so great about the 60s?
Well, my first concert was the Rolling Stones.
Oh, wow, that's cool.
Wow, talk about set the bar high.
Yeah, and it was a year of revolution where music changed and, starting with Buddy Holly and the Crickets and through the Rolling Stones and some of those American groups, and it just set the scene for music for moving forward. And don't get me wrong, they built well on it. There were some good groups in the 90s, but only because of the groups of the 60s.
Oh, I love it. You're giving me historical nostalgia for the 60s, Tim.
Me too.
Thank you, Tim. You have a fantastic Friday.
Thanks a lot.
Well, we could keep talking forever. Dan Woodman, Professor of Sociology at the University of Melbourne, but we do have to wrap. Thank you so much for coming in and helping us be nostalgic.
Thanks, Georgie. That was a lot of fun.
Have a great day. You're listening to The Conversation Hour.
This is The Conversation Hour with Georgie Coghlan.
Well, you might want to brace yourself with this one because it's one of the most unexpected cultural comebacks of the moment and it's stomping its way back into fashion. We're talking about boot scooting or line dancing. What started as a nostalgic throwback, we're talking all things nostalgia today, aren't we, is now being described as almost life-changing for a new wave of young people, with classes filling up across Australia, including right here in Melbourne. And it's not just about the dancing. Participants say it's about connection, it's about confidence, it's about mental well-being and health, using our brains. Maybe another way to help prevent dementia, who knows? It's a sense of community that's really hard to find elsewhere in a sometimes hyper-connected but often disconnected world. So today we're asking, we've been focusing a lot on Gen Z, why are they also lining up to dance their way into something their grandparents probably thought that they'd left behind? Danielle Legderick, I hope I'm saying that right, Danielle. She's a senior lecturer and head of course graduate certificate in nursing from CQ University in Australia. Good morning, Danielle.
Good morning. It's Legderick.
Ludlagovic, thank you, Danielle. Apologies for butchering your name.
No problem.
First of all, Danielle, do you boot scoot?
Absolutely. A line dance.
Oh, so do you call it, what's the difference? Do you call it line dancing? Is it that the Australian way compared to boot scooting is more American?
I reckon we don't distinguish, but, you know, we just call it line dancing. And it's not just for young people, huh?
Okay.
Everybody does it.
Well, let's break this down. So according to Eventbrite, line dancing listings are up to 165%. That's significant. What do you think's creating the increase in the interest in line dancing?
I think it started with COVID. You know, that the time of isolation, once those COVID restrictions were lifted, people just wanted to get back together again. And line dancing really took off. And during COVID, there was a lot of people trawling the internet looking for things to do. And there were so many tutorials that sprung up, line dancing tutorials. People got into it online. And so once they could get together again, it was just such fun. Everybody just got together and started line dancing again.
So, Danielle, my images of boot scooting are very much Achy Breaky Heart, Billy Ray Cyrus. Has it changed? Has it evolved?
Absolutely. We line dance to almost anything. There's classic waltzes, there's tangos, there's modern break music, there's some of the most modern music we line dance to. Even some of the AI-generated music we now line dance to. It's anything.
Maybe, Danielle, we can thank Beyonce because her Cowboy Carter album, of course, was massive. And, you know, she really introduced, she went from, you know, this incredible pop queen to moving over to country. Do you think that that has been significant in helping people move across?
It could have been, but it's not all about country. And many people don't even associate line dancing with country music anymore.
Well, hang on. What do you play then? Because I'm always thinking line dancing is I'm going to go there and listen to country music. What am I listening to?
No. You could be listening to anything. We even line dance to Zorba the Greek. So really, a piece of music comes out and somebody will put some steps together that we can line dance to.
And would I hear maybe a bit of Kylie or Robbie Williams?
Very possibly.
Okay.
We have new dances coming out almost every week.
So can you give us a visual of the room, Danielle? It's not just young people, it's old people. How is it helping people in their search for community and connection?
It brings us all together. One of the great advantages of line dancing is that it's an unpartnered dance. So it's particularly popular in the little regional area where I live with the elderly people. Because very often they've lost their partners or their partners are not feeling up to dancing anymore. So it's no problem. It's often just a congregation of ladies that get together with maybe one or two men. We all dance in rows and we're all doing more or less the same thing because it's a repetitive steps that we follow. Mm-hmm. And it's just such a community. It's all about the fun, not about the technique.
I think I need to take up some line dancing, Danielle. I think I need to find out whether there is some line dancing. I'm sure there's line dancing clubs in Ballarat, surely. They must be everywhere, right?
Oh, you know, I'm in a little town called Bundaberg in Queensland, and we must have at least four different line dancing groups here in Bundaberg.
Oh, I love it.
Okay. No problem.
Your favourite song to boot scoot to or line dance to, Danielle? What would be your top one?
Oh, I couldn't tell you. There's so many. I just love them all.
And how often do you line dance each week?
Once a week, just once a week, because I work full time. So I go on a Saturday morning with a whole lot of other ladies and a few gentlemen, and we line dance.
Oh, absolutely love it. Okay, so it's back. Line dancing's back. You need to find out. Danielle, Senior Lecturer and Head of Course of Graduate Certificate in Nursing from CQ University in Australia, thank you so much for speaking to us on The Conversation Hour, and you keep boot scooting.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, particularly to Amber and John. You have a wonderful weekend, and I'll see you next time I'm in.